Ford Channel. But I wanted to let you know immediately that our investigation has taken a dramatic leap forward.
He sat on the edge of his seat, energized to the point of exhilaration. Whatever had happened on Daxam 4 hadn't only been useful. Ransom had enjoyed himself immensely. At least someone was having fun. As his image faded, Leia murmured, "We're going to have plenty to talk about."
"Shall I queue more messages for you, Princess Leia?"
C-3PO asked.
"There are, oh my, nearly 4 dozen more."
"I've heard enough for now." She got to her feet, aware of every aching muscle in her back. All she wanted was to return to her bunk and sleep most of the way back to Hosnian Prime. Yet she realized that Joff and Corey were sitting in the cockpit silently. Corey hugged herself. Joff kept fiddling with instruments he must have already set and checked. Their youthful confidence seemed to have been drained away from them. Leia went to the doorway. "Everything all right in here?"
"Yes, Your Highness."
Corey sounded even more expressionless than a primitive droid, and Joff simply nodded. "Hey," Leia said. "Come on, what's the matter? If something's bothering you about our findings, about any part of this mission..."
"It's not that, ma'am."
Joff had never sounded so grave to her before.
"It's just that listening to those news reports, well, things sound bad."
Corey added,
"They were bad before, but now, Princess Leia, do you think the New Republic could collapse?"
Leia had asked herself if the Senate would break down, whether they would come to a constitutional crisis. She wondered whether the napkin bombing would provoke some kind of conflict on a smaller scale. But she had not consciously believed total governmental collapse could come to pass. And if it did, war would come along with it. Only now did Leia understand that she'd been calculating that risk all along, moving it closer and closer to the realm of the possible within her own mind. Corey's fear did not shock Leia as much as the realization that she'd been coming to this conclusion herself. "I won't lie to you." Leia looked down at Joff and Corey, recognizing anew how young they were. If she could not act as a mother to her own son right now, she could at least help these two through the difficult days to come. If the two factions within the Senate continue tearing each other apart like this, schism is a possibility. But just because it's possible doesn't mean it's probable. We still have time to work things out.
"But will we?"
Corey asked in a small voice. "I hope so," Leia said. What she truly felt was closer to determination than hope. The devastation of the war, the countless lives lost in combat, the sheer terrible waste of it. They couldn't let that happen again. Surely the other senators from the rest of the galaxy felt the same way. Surely. There has to be a way out of this, Leia thought. And it's up to me to find it. Chapter 19. Leia watched the Force Pike duel play out on screen, the image bright in her darkened office. Ransom stood by her side, and although he was obviously attempting to be modest, she could almost feel self-satisfaction radiating from him. But if he could fight like that, Ransom had every reason for pride. As the recording of the duel ended, Leia looked up at him over her shoulder. "I'm glad we're on the same side." He couldn't entirely suppress his smile. "Now you know how I felt when I saw you taking down Jabba the Hutt." Even though they'd each arrived on Hosnian Prime late at night, they'd wanted to meet at once. The Senate buildings were closest to the hangar they both used, so her office it was. Despite the urgency, Leia had been famished and eager for something besides the rations aboard the Mirrorbright, so she'd stopped at a takeout Ivaru Jari place for some boxes of spicy noodles. Ransom had turned out to be a fan of Ivaru Jari cuisine as well, so they'd turned her office desk into a sort of picnic table, eating while they worked by the light of a few candle droids. Each of them wore simple traveling clothes in gray or tan, and Ransom hadn't bothered wearing his usual sweeping cloak. All of the useless pomposity of the Galactic Senate had been swept away, leaving her and Ransom to get down to real work. The Amaxine warriors trust you. They even think they've recruited you. Leia picked up her box of noodles. We have to use that. Ransom took his seat again.
Agreed. But how and when? If we move too quickly, they'll become suspicious.
The timing of all this confused Leia nearly as much as it intrigued her. When you met with the Amaxine warriors, they were confident, even triumphant. But Rinriven Dai had traveled to a world where he's almost entirely separated from his criminal activities, and the napkin bombing made him angry. He prides himself on keeping his temper, but this got to him.
You mean you believe the Amaxine warriors and Rinriven Dai are at odds? We were so sure they were conspirators.
The two aren't mutually exclusive. The various bits of intel they'd gathered swirled around in her thoughts like moths. Leia had to pull together the strings of the plot, to weave a cobweb that would catch them all in their proper places. We know Rinriven Dai's cartel is connected to the Amaxine warriors. Either the Amaxine warriors set Rinriven up in the first place, or the same entity is funding them both. Ransom weighed her words, utensil and noodle box in his hands.
The napkin bombing affected each in different ways. The Amaxine warriors were emboldened, while Rinriven felt threatened. Do you believe the Amaxine warriors themselves were responsible?
The timing is right. And it feels right. Leia could sense herself being tugged in that direction as surely as a compass needle was pulled by a magnetic pole. Still, she needed to back up her instincts with logic. But what did the Amaxine warriors have to gain by the bombing? And why go to the trouble of planting a bomb and then warning the victims when they didn't even claim responsibility? They risk exposure even though they want to stay hidden.
Hidden for now, Ransom interjected. I doubt Hadrosian would have gone to the trouble of luring me to Daxam 4 had she not envisioned finding other allies in the Senate for her group, and soon. Still, even if the Amaxine warriors are nearly ready to emerge, I can't think what they had to gain by the bombing. The only result has been property damage and a great deal of confusion. The strands came together, weaving their cobweb pattern at last. Leia sat up straight.
That's it. Confusion. That's what they were after.
Ransom swallowed. What do you mean?
Our investigation of Rinriven Dai was official, public. The Amaxine warriors would have been watching closely from the beginning. Rinriven tried to bribe me into complacency on Bastatha, and he failed.
He was catching on, nodding as he said, It was no coincidence we first saw Hadrasian on Bastatha. She was there to watch us, maybe to orchestrate Rinriven's kidnapping attempt.
Exactly. Then you and I addressed the Senate jointly, a populist and a centrist. Even though we could hardly get anyone to listen, we were both publicly pushing for a wider investigation. Finally, word gets out that I'm probably going to be the populist candidate for first senator, which would give me the authority to get to the bottom of this in no time.
Leia attempted to imagine herself as Arlys Hadrosian, an imperial loyalist watching a hero of the rebellion on the brink of taking power.
They needed a distraction, something that would paralyze the Senate completely. And they sure got one.
It would explain Rinriven's anger as well.
Ransom leaned forward, one forearm on her desk.
His cartel only thrives if it remains hidden. If the napkin bombing is linked to the Amaxine warriors, Rinriven will be dragged into the light along with them.
She breathed a sigh of both relief and resignation. I think we've hit on the strongest possible suspect. The question is, how do we prove it? Until this point, Ransom had been completely with her. But now his gaze drifted down to the table, awkward or ashamed. Leia couldn't understand his reaction until he quietly said, we also have to know whether the Amaxine warriors have help. The ties to centrist worlds could be coincidental, but perhaps not. If anyone in my own faction is abetting this kind of violence, we must be the ones to expose them. Leia took care with her next words. So, I try to steer the official investigation into the bombing in the right direction, while you make sure no centrist senator is involved. She could not show any suspicion of the centrists herself, not without solid proof. If she did so, Ransom's defensiveness might take over. He put integrity over party loyalty. She knew that about him now. But she also knew how easily his pride could be bruised. Her words had been well chosen because Ransom nodded. A good plan. In the meanwhile, I take it, we both find out as much as we can about this mysterious planet that's so important to both the Amaxine warriors and Rinriven Dai. Exactly, Leia said. Soon, we'll need to find out what's on Cybensko. What or who? Several centrist senators were avid acquirers of Imperial artifacts. Ransom's collection was far from the most impressive in the Senate offices. However, a mask of the Emperor's Royal Guard would be considered a prize by anyone in collecting circles. That gave Ransom an excuse to throw a party. A reception, really. Ransom supposed a gathering of a few dozen or so senators in his own office hardly counted as a party. A few glasses of Corellian brandy passed around while people looked at historical artifacts. That didn't live up to the wild indulgence of Hosnian Prime's most famous hosts, such as Varish Vickley. But it served Ransom's purpose, bringing a good 30 centrist senators together and loosening their tongues. "Like new," said gray-haired Senator Opalin of Kuat, with great satisfaction. He held his second glass of brandy in one hand. "I remember seeing the Royal Guard in person once when I visited Coruscant. Imagine how imposing this looked in life." Ransom murmured the right things while noting, "Visited Coruscant during Imperial rule. Got close enough to Palpatine to see the Royal Guard."
"His connections to the Empire have to have been stronger than he publicly admits."
Senator Fatil of Arinda, a blonde woman roughly Ransom's own age, wasn't content with admiring the helmet. She had to inspect and praise every single item in his collection. "Even the uniforms suggest power," she murmured, standing very close to Ransom as she traced her fingers over a TIE pilot's black mask. "They command respect, awe, submission. She wants to either bring back the Empire or take me to bed," Ransom thought. "Possibly both." The brandy continued to flow, and conversation became more candid. "You didn't hear so much complaining in those days. Worlds knew they were responsible for their own messes. Didn't come whining to the Emperor about every little cyclone or drought." "The academies on populist worlds, they've become jokes. Poor imitations of what the academies were like a generation ago, where the best and brightest trained to serve their leader. Now, on centrist worlds, we're rebuilding the old programs of study, re-establishing standards. About time, too."
"If the will of the galaxy were truly so anti-Empire, there's no way so much of the Imperial fleet could have escaped. No way they wouldn't have been hunted down, no matter where they tried to hide. There are still friends of the Empire out there."
"To this day, they've never adequately explained what happened to the first Death Star. Yes, we all know the big story, Luke Skywalker, single starfighter, blah, 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 but honestly, does that sound credible to you? The Empire had the greatest engineers in the galaxy, and the Death Star was their finest achievement. There's no way it could have been vulnerable to that kind of attack. The Emperor had to have been betrayed by someone on the inside."
Ransom heard nothing that pointed directly to the Amaxine warriors, or any general knowledge of a pro-Empire militia. If any of these senators were linked to Hadrassian's organization, They were too clever to speak of it, even indirectly, even when slightly drunk. Yet what he heard troubled him even more. These people, his political allies, weren't merely interested in greater centralization and efficiency. They waxed nostalgic for the Empire itself. For Palpatine. For the fear and obedience planets showed in the aftermath of Alderaan's destruction. The worst aspects of the Empire, the very things Ransom hoped to wipe away in a new order, were the elements of control these people most wanted to bring back. One man who served as chief of staff for Lady Carice Sindian even said, "Lord Vader was nearly a second emperor. One totally loyal to Palpatine, yet capable of exercising ultimate authority in his own right. Can you imagine any leader today commanding such obedience?" Ransom turned as if to refill his own glass, because he knew he could not disguise the contempt on his face. To talk about Vader as if he were admirable. To praise the way Vader followed orders, even when those orders were to work people to death in his factories while their starving children watched. He took a deep breath, composed himself, and returned to the gathering with a smile on his face. The small hypocrisies of politics had to be mastered. Once everyone had departed and the cleaning droids were hard at work, Ransom sat at his desk for a while, staring at his collection. It looked so handsome now with the red Royal Guard mask at the center of the far wall. He'd worked for years to bring all the pieces together, and he still felt proud of them. But he was no longer proud to be counted among the others who valued these artifacts. To him, the Imperial relics stood for strength. To the others, they stood for domination.
At last,
Lady Carice thought as the cloth of gold mantle was settled on her shoulders.
At last, I have a title of my own.
She knelt in the Great Hall of Beeren, at the head of a crowd of hundreds before their arbiter. After weeks of ritual and ceremony, she was finally being given the symbolic tokens of leadership, mantle and scepter, to show that she would both shelter and defend her people. In spirit, at least. Lady Carice had no intention of removing herself from the central position of the Galactic Senate to administrate on a backwater world like Beeren. But the Beerenese didn't expect her to. In fact, they seemed to regard the ceremonies almost as a nuisance. Insolent, she thought, but irrelevant. When she strode through the Great Hall with the mantle on her shoulders and the scepter in her hands, applause rang out, and the new governor had finally completed her rituals. She had planned a grand fete for the evening with plenty of fireworks and music, and she intended to arrive in style.
"No need to do this today, m'lady governor."
The warden of the treasures was a stout woman of middle years, respectful but puzzled by Lady Carice's insistence.
"You've plenty of time to go through Lord Mellowin's things."
"The ball doesn't begin for another few hours."
Lady Carice's shoulders ached under the weight of the mantle.
"We might as well begin."
With resignation, the warden consented, switching all the locks to align with Lady Carice's fingerprints and retinal scans. The older woman bowed as she backed out, leaving Lady Carice alone. Leaning forward, Lady Carice let the scanners check her eyes and her hands, though impatience made it hard for her to stand still. Beeren's connections to the Elder Houses went back for centuries. Who knew what priceless items awaited inside? She wouldn't have taken any of them away from Beeren. She took her role as governor seriously, and would not have abandoned her honor for a few jewels or a little gold. But she could use any of these things while on this world. If there were an exceptionally alluring gemstone necklace, or a sparkling tiara here in the chamber, wouldn't it be a shame to let them sit neglected when she could instead wear them tonight? Heavy gears turned and clicked within the enormous lock, whining like whale song. The tall bronze doors swung open at last, and in the darkness only vague shapes could be seen. Enthralled, Lady Carice motioned the candle droids forward, dashed in after them, and stopped.
This is it?
The treasures of Beeren added up to no more than a couple of moldering old chests, some gilded furnishings that had seen better days, 3 or 4 obsolete droids waiting to be reawakened, and a few bits of jewelry that had more shine than substance. Lady Carice picked up one of the bracelets, sniffed, and let it fall again. So much for her hopes of grandeur. Annoyed and bored, with nothing to do until she readied herself for the ball, Lady Carice began poking around amid the treasures, trying to guess why any of it would have been kept. Did the droids have sentimental value, perhaps? Did someone think that atrocious style of furniture would come back into fashion? Not likely, in her opinion. Just when she began to think she might as well leave, she lifted a carved wooden box and saw that it had been engraved, "For Princess Leia Organa of Alderaan." Lady Carice perked up. Lord Mellowin must have wanted to give some sort of present to his successor, whom he would have assumed would be Princess Leia. By delivering this box to the princess, Lady Carice would fulfill her sacred duty as governor, and perhaps finally win some respect from Leia. It was about time. And if there happened to be jewelry in there worth the wearing, well, the princess wouldn't mind if Lady Carice borrowed it just once, for a special occasion. She sat in one of the gilded chairs and opened the box. Wrinkling her nose, she began to paw through the useless things there. A tiny doll no taller than her hand. A small, soft blanket of fine gillendown. A hexagonal, mirrored music box. A ring sized for a tiny finger. And a lock of dark brown hair tied at either end with ribbon. These were childhood mementos. No more. So much for the jewelry. But after taking a moment to think it over, Lady Carice decided this was even better. Princess Leia would no doubt become emotional upon receiving these. She would be even more grateful to Lady Carice. Yes, this would work very well. Idly, Lady Carice picked up the music box and opened it. She recognized the song immediately. It was a traditional Alderaanian lullaby, one Carice's grandmother had sung when she felt sentimental about her homeworld. The words welled in her memory. "Mirror bright shines the moon, its glow as soft as an ember. When the moon is mirror bright, take this time to remember. Those you have loved but are gone, those who kept you so safe and warm, the mirror bright moon lets you see those who have ceased to be. Mirror bright shines the moon as fires die to their embers. Those you loved are with you still. The moon will help you remember." It was a sadder song than Lady Carice had realized. What a thing to sing to children. Nor had Alderaan ever had a moon. Probably it was symbolic, she thought. Poetic, the sort of nonsense Alderaanians put so much stock in. The music dropped slightly in volume, which usually meant a voice would start singing along. But instead, a man began speaking.
"My beloved daughter, the Supreme Governor of Beeren, whom I trust completely, said that he would keep this here for you when you someday inherit this title. My hope is that this recording contains no new information, that I have had the chance to explain everything to you myself."
Lady Carice realized the speaker could only be Bail Organa. She covered her mouth with her hand, eyes wide, as she listened to the voice of a man now dead nearly 30 years, speaking for his daughter's ears only.
"However, I make this recording during a time of increasing danger for our rebellion. I know too well that I may not survive the war that is surely to come. By hiding the information here, on a world of no significance to the Empire, I hope to keep it out of the wrong hands and deliver it into yours. For this is knowledge you, and only you, have the right to possess.
Probably he would now start going on about war secrets, no longer secret, about a war that had ended decades ago. Lady Carice rolled her eyes, deciding Princess Leia would probably like this even more. She loved nothing so much as reminding the galaxy what a great war hero she'd been. A recording like this from her father would be marvelous propaganda fodder. How long before it was played for the public as part of Princess Leia's campaign to be first senator?
You've never expressed much interest in knowing about your birth parents. So many times you've told your mother and me we are the only father and mother you've ever needed. And never doubt how much that means to us both. But Leia, the story of your origin is one you must know. You were hidden with us for your own safety and for that of your brother. Yes, you have a twin brother, though you must not seek him until the war has ended and both Palpatine and Lord Vader have been defeated.
Princess Leia's brother was the Jedi Luke Skywalker. Why would Bail Organa have forbidden his daughter to seek Skywalker out? And what was this mysterious origin story? Lady Carice leaned closer, and the glinting light from the mirrored surface of the music box reflected on her face.
Obi-Wan Kenobi took your brother for safekeeping, and I took you. We hid you both from each other and from your father, who could not know that any child of his had been born alive. You see, Leia, I always told you the truth about your mother and how she died. But I never told you that she was Padme Amidala, former queen and senator of the planet Naboo.
A war orphan? And yet a royal by birth? Surprised as Lady Carice was, she decided that made sense. Leia's nobility was indeed in her blood. But Bail Organa continued,
Nor could I share that your father was Anakin Skywalker, one of the last Jedi Knights and a great hero of the Clone Wars. But now I must tell you the worst, and you must be strong. I must tell you what became of Anakin Skywalker.
Lady Carice's hand gripped the music box more tightly as she listened to the next few seconds. Her astonishment coalescing into dread as Bail Organa spelled out the entire truth of a man's descent into darkness. And yet she was unprepared for the moment she heard the words,
Your father has become Darth Vader.
She snapped the music box shut, silencing Organa's voice. Then she dropped the music box back in the small chest, after which she shut it too. Lady Carice put the chest on the floor, kicked it farther from her, decided that wasn't far enough, and got out of her chair to back away from the thing until her shoulder blades collided with the chamber's stone wall. Dazed, almost faint, she kept staring at the small wooden chest that held a secret with the power to change the course of the galaxy. Darth Vader was the father of Princess Leia. Of Luke Skywalker, too, but this detail was nearly irrelevant to Lady Carice. Skywalker had been so long away on his strange quest for the lore of the Jedi that he no longer had much influence outside his own acolytes. He was a figure of myth more than one of flesh and blood. Princess Leia, however, she had power. If she were elected first senator, she would become the ultimate authority in the entire galaxy. But the child of a figure so widely hated as Darth Vader could never win that election. Lady Carice realized she had been given the one thing that could ensure victory for the centrists. The untouchable, unimpeachable heroine, Leia Organa, could be toppled off her pedestal forever merely by playing this recording in public. Yet she had taken all the sacred oaths of the governorship of Beeren. Those oaths matched the ones shared by most of the elder houses, which included keeping any secret under the royal seal, and the entire Chamber of Treasures was under such a seal. If Lady Carice exposed this recording and let Princess Leia's true parentage be known, she would have broken her sacred vow. She would have betrayed the royal seal. It would be the same as saying that nobility meant nothing.
But Princess Leia is a liar and a fraud. She's kept this secret from everyone all these years. Didn't we deserve to know?
Then again, perhaps the princess didn't even know the truth. Bail Organa had probably never had the chance to tell his daughter any of this, since the recording made it clear he thought it would be dangerous for her to seek her brother before the end of the war. Somehow, Princess Leia had learned his identity, and her mother's too, which implied she knew the truth about her father as well. But that implication was far from proof. It took only a few moments for Lady Carice to make her decision. Nobility was more important than rabble-rousing. A royal seal had to remain inviolate. She could fulfill her oath and keep this secret, maybe even from Princess Leia herself. However, she intended to hold on to the chest and its contents, just in case. Chapter 20.
I could get used to this, Joff said.
Greer gave him a sideways glance as she brought their ancient Y-wing into orbit around the space station.
Running around under assumed names? Not telling anyone where we're really going? Following orders Princess Leia might not actually have the legal authority to give?
Exactly.
He folded his hands behind his head as he leaned back in the chair, his thick golden hair the least convincing halo imaginable. Sometimes, despite his youth and sunny disposition, Joff Seastriker's yen for trouble made him come across more like a potential smuggler than a New Republic pilot.
You still crave excitement.
Greer shook her head as she began signaling for a docking berth.
Wait until you get some.
Come on! We're on a secret mission! We've already saved the princess from kidnapping once, and I even rigged a mobster's satellites. That absolutely 100% counts as excitement.
His blue eyes narrowed, momentarily less innocent, more searching.
You know, there's something I don't get. At this point, you've proved 1,000 times that you don't like playing it safe. So why do you keep pretending that you do?
Greer remembered the day she'd walked away from her racer. The way Han Solo's hands had closed over hers as he said a gruff goodbye to her that would allow them both to pretend there weren't tears in her eyes.
You're still a kid, aren't you? You still think recklessness is a virtue, or that you can only prove you're brave by risking your life. Staying alive as long as you can to do some good in this world.
The word caught in her throat, but she pushed on.
That's not playing it safe. That's our job.
Joff sat up, suddenly serious, his expression gentler than she'd known it could be. He'd finally glimpsed some shadow of the truth she'd tried so hard to hide.
Hey, if there's something I ought to know, or something we need to talk about, whatever, you know you can tell me, right?
There's nothing worth telling.
A green light on the console began flashing. Docking clearance granted.
Let's go in,
Greer said, focusing on the task at hand and, she hoped, changing the subject. She and Joff had scrounged up the cheapest used ship they could find, one so battered that buying it was less expensive than renting anything else. Greer thought it might have been banged up in the Clone Wars and patched back into service every few years since. Any two young pilots flying around in a ship this rickety would obviously be hungry for work of any kind at any price. When they'd gone to Pamarth, they'd wanted to come across as pilots looking for a job. Now they needed to actually get a job, one that would take them to Sibensko. Space stations generally served as military outposts and had for generations. Some planets kept their own civilian stations operational, primarily for the use of pleasure craft. But this station, adrift in deep space, was unique. Abandoned by asteroid miners more than a century earlier, it had been taken over by smugglers, slavers, and others who valued a place to do business where no planetary laws applied. Any repairs and updates to the station had been undertaken by individual spice runners and low-life pilots, When and if these individuals happened to notice something that required fixing, when and if they had the time, money, and inclination to actually do something about it. As such, the space station Chrome Citadel looked like it might fall apart at any second. The various repairs appeared to have been piecemeal at best. Chrome Citadel's rough, conical hull had been patched with different shades and types of metal, its namesake shiny surface long since buried beneath layers of duller stuff, and many sensors that would normally be shielded within station atmosphere had instead simply been bolted on wherever they would fit. Although the work was inconsistent and shoddy, it had somehow been enough to keep the thing going despite its dilapidation.
Only desperate people would come here, Greer thought as she brought their ship in for docking. Anyone else would stay far away.
Joff looked askance at a particularly dodgy piece of patchwork near one of the main vents.
Are we sure about the atmospheric controls in there? Because this thing seems like it might vent all its air any second.
Greer shrugged.
Only one way to find out.
Inside the Chrome Citadel, chaos ruled. As Joff and Greer walked from their docking port, they merged with the busy foot traffic of a few dozen species, each one a pilot or a trader, several of them familiar from wanted hollows in respectable spaceports, most of them probably very dangerous. Every corridor was lined with makeshift stalls selling everything from dehydrated deep space rations to fashionable headscarves. Greer bought a red one and knotted it around her thick black hair as she saw some of the bush pilots do. While both she and Joff had worn loose, rumpled coveralls, they still looked too tidy and respectable for the rough crew in this place. Joff also had noticed that they stuck out, and they quickly stopped at one of the nearest stalls.
What do you think they'd do if they knew?
He murmured as he strapped on the leather tool harness he'd just bought. After taking a long look at the motley crowd of humans and non-humans, every one of them armed, Greer said,
If they knew, we'd be thrown out of the nearest airlock.
He nodded toward one farther down the corridor, which looked as though it had been painted and enameled over dozens of times since it was last opened.
At least it looks like most of the airlocks don't work.
Greer sighed.
We've got that going for us, then.
A group of Otegans swaggered past, smelling faintly of spice. Humans with their red hair plaited in ropes bickered with a droid shopkeeper about the cost of a new welding torch. A Hask woman kept her furred hand on her blaster, eyes darting toward every passage and corner, never relaxing her guard for a moment.
Hey,
Joff murmured, nudging Greer's shoulder.
Check that out.
She followed his gaze toward a stall near the far curve of this corridor. Amid the booths hawking flasks of counterfeit Corellian brandy and scan-proof shipping containers was one that sold decorative trinkets. Flags, hollow cubes, good luck charms, decals and such. And hanging amid the flags, front and center, was the banner of the Empire. Other Imperial emblems showed up as well. A hollow of a benevolently smiling Palpatine, taken from some old propaganda message, and decals in the shape of the Imperial insignia. But they were only a handful of the items on display, crowded in among popular characters from hollow comedies or galactic folklore, colorful abstract patterns, and even the insignias of the New Republic and the old Rebel Alliance. Greer tried to put things in perspective.
They're kitsch. The stuff our parents and grandparents owned, so people buy them ironically. More a joke than anything else.
I don't know.
Joff shook his head.
It makes the Empire look like something out of a story. Something that wasn't real. If you ask me, buying stuff like that and showing it off like it's no big deal, it disrespects the old Rebel pilots, you know? They went up against the Death Stars in X-Wings. And we're repaying them by treating Palpatine like he was only a boogeyman out of a kid's story?
On most worlds, the seediest cantina was where the most lucrative, least legal jobs were to be found. On the Chrome Citadel, the cantina was nearly the one place people didn't seek work. It was only for drinking, dancing, and checking the room for any member of the genders and species you found attractive. Work was instead traded openly at the station's highest point, the tip of the cone, via an open message market.
"Look sharp,"
Greer murmured, as she and Joff walked into the room, where various electronic display boards shone with rapidly scrolling messages, rows and rows of them, each promising work at a certain level of pay. Pilots crowded around, standing near small, waist-height consoles with quick key-in controls. Greer remembered these from some of the less upright areas of Pomarth, where people sought her homeworld's famously daring flyers.
"These jobs go to whoever punches in fastest."
Joff frowned.
"Who'd post work here instead of vetting the pilots themselves? This is supposed to be sensitive stuff, right? The kind of things you don't want to get caught doing?"
"Exactly."
She kept her eyes focused on the board, scanning as many messages simultaneously as possible.
"The kind of thing you don't want to get caught hiring people for. Much more likely to be illegal than anything they'd advertise for on Pomarth. Message rooms like this transfer the risk to the pilots, which pretty much guarantees the work here is the most dangerous of all."
In other words, precisely where they were likely to find work connected to Arlys Hadrasian, Rinriven Dai, or the Amaxine Warriors. "Live cargo to Nal Hutta, no questions asked." That would be a call for a slaver. Greer's lip curled in disgust. 200 kilos GS from Care of Doi to Tatooine." No doubt GS stood for Glitter Stim. "Bounty announced for live capture of smuggler in arrears. Identity and images of quarry on acceptance only."
Bounty hunters too?
Greer shuddered. Joff's hand shot past her to hit the console, tagging one of the jobs. Only as the message faded from the scrolling screens and appeared on the console in front of them did she see its words. "Transport materiel from Daxum 4 to Sibensko. Discretion valued."
"Quick eye,"
she said to Joff.
"Thanks."
He was trying hard not to sound too proud of himself, and failing. The console's glow shifted to red as another message appeared at the bottom of their screen. "Accept or decline to re-release job." Swiftly, Greer hit the button that said accept. After hours of debate at the populist meeting that night, most of which had been spent blaming the centrist ministers for the napkin bombing with much invective and little proof, Leia had a headache, a prickly temper, and a strong desire to do nothing more strenuous than laying her head on her pillow. But just after she'd changed into her nightgown, the very moment she reached for her bed covers to pull them back, her comm unit blinked with a new message. She thought maybe it would be from Han, but instead found the message was encoded. After C-3PO had been roused from his recharging station and translated it for her, whatever disappointment Leia felt at not hearing from her husband had evaporated in a blaze of excitement. "We couldn't have asked for anything better," she said as she paced the floor of her main room, the long hem of her nightgown swirling around her feet. "This gives us a direct link between Daxum 4 and Sibensko."
"Yes, your highness."
C-3PO, ever eager to please, had to serve as sounding board.
"Do you think Mistress Sonnel and Lieutenant Seastriker will be taking on cargo that is, shall we say, incriminating?"
The job specified materiel. That almost always means armaments, explosives, items necessary for military action. Leia paused, thumping her hand against the back of her long sofa. It's possible the work may be entirely legal. The Amaxine Warriors might be hiring like this only because they hope to keep this secret. Still, it doesn't matter. We don't need to catch them committing a crime. At least not yet. We only need to get ourselves into Sibensko, and this job should do that.
"I beg your pardon, your highness, but it sounds as if..."
C-3PO's pause was broken only by the sound of his internal gears whirring as he turned toward her.
"Why, rather as if you intended to accompany Mistress Sonnel and Lieutenant Seastriker on their mission."
Leia hadn't realized that, hadn't consciously made a decision one way or the other, and had hardly even acknowledged there was a decision to be made. Yet the droid's programming analyzed human conversation so thoroughly that he sometimes pointed out subtleties she'd missed. "I guess it does sound like that," she said slowly. "I guess I do."
"But Princess Leia!"
C-3PO's voice rose in alarm.
"You can't! The mission sounds terribly dangerous!"
"3PO, in the quarter century you've served me, have you ever known me to run away from danger?"
"Well, no."
The droid considered this a moment before adding hopefully,
"Yet you might eventually develop a stronger instinct for survival."
Leia couldn't help laughing. "Don't count on it." C-3PO never thought faster than when he was trying to keep himself out of the latest round of trouble.
"Captain Solo would no doubt be highly concerned."
"Captain Solo once piloted us into an asteroid field, remember? He doesn't get to lecture anyone on taking risks. Anyway, I outrank him."
"But you cannot leave Hosnian Prime at this point in the political process. Your candidacy will be officially announced within a few weeks. Then your presence within the Galactic Senate will be crucial. Surely there will be appearances to coordinate on other worlds as well."
He had a point. Once she became an official candidate, the demands on Leia's time would increase exponentially. She would be expected to give speeches on planets from the galactic core to the expansion region. Broadcasters would clamor for interviews. Greer would have to schedule studio time for holos to be distributed galaxy-wide, showing Leia speaking about her policy proposals. Above all, she'd need to be active in the Senate, demonstrating that she was engaged, dynamic, and committed. In other words, as soon as she became a candidate, Leia would have time for nothing else. Especially not secret missions that might take down what looked likely to be the biggest spice cartel in the galaxy. She shut her eyes and took a deep breath. "You're right. As soon as my nomination as first senator becomes official, I won't have time for this." C-3PO practically preened.
"I am glad to have been of service."
"Which is why we have to get to Cybensko before the announcement."
"Oh, no! If you'll pardon me for saying so, Your Highness, won't any absence from the Senate be seen as a potential lack of commitment? Appearances are so important."
She shook her head. "I've given my life to duty since I was 14 years old. Anyone who doubts my commitment at this point is a fool whose opinion I can safely ignore."
"Of course, Your Highness."
"So my trip to Cybensko is on." C-3PO paused again.
"This means danger, doesn't it?"
"You'd better believe it." Leia flopped down on her sofa, smiling. "Bring up my calendars, will you? I want to start thinking about the best time to do this." Shuffling toward the nearest information bank, C-3PO wistfully said,
"It's enough to make one wish to go back to programming binary load lifters."
The duel on Daxum 4 had gone well, but it had also reminded Ransom Casterfo that he had to keep his skills sharp. Since it appeared he had a use for this sort of thing even now that he was a senator, he didn't intend to let himself get rusty. In the stark white training chamber, he remained stock still, poised with the quarterstaff in his hand. His form-fitting gray workout gear had been drenched with sweat for a long time now, but Ransom remained determined to press on. Most people neglected training with non-powered weapons. These were the same people who got themselves killed because their blasters ran out of charge. He intended to be able to fight with whatever was at hand, whether as sophisticated as the latest model of vibroblade or as brutish as a long stick. The projectors in the corners of the training chamber shimmered, creating the illusion of a Mandalorian warrior with a blaster in his hand. Instantly, Ransom swung upward, striking the blaster's muzzle with his quarterstaff. The holographic bolts shot uselessly over Ransom's head. Although the pre-programmed Mandalorian attempted to compensate, skidding back into a crouch, Ransom was ready for him. With one savage thrust, he plunged the end of the quarterstaff through the Mandalorian's head, even faster than the man would have been able to fire. The hollow shimmered into nothingness. Ransom smiled. He'd won again. After another few rounds, once his muscles were quivering and his empty belly demanded food, Ransom finally headed back to his quarters. A swift ride on the border monorail took him to his apartment, which was a fairly humble one by senatorial standards. But what was the point in spending a lot of money on a place where he lived alone, and that he used only to sleep? His was a bachelor apartment, with utilitarian furnishings that had come with the place, in a combination of the gray and orange colors so in vogue at the moment as to be completely generic. Stashing his quarterstaff in his equipment closet, Ransom began settling in for the evening. He rubbed his sweat-damp hair with a towel, slung that around his neck, and began searching through the kitchen to see whether anything edible remained. His comm unit blinked. Someone was calling. Ransom quickly went to the unit to answer. As he hit the panel, a hollow of Princess Leia took shape within his living room.
Leia?
He smiled as he sat heavily on his sofa, spreading his weary arms across the back. To what do I owe the honor? It's rather late for a social call. Her lips quirked, evidence of the excitement she was trying to hold back.
Would you consider an invitation to Cybensko social?
You're joking, he breathed. However did Greer and Joff manage it?
They went to the right place, snagged the right job. They'll be transporting materiel. Schedule is somewhat flexible, it seems, but they'll need to act soon.
Outstanding.
I intend to go with them.
She grinned at Ransom then in unconcealed anticipation. In that moment, it occurred to him that in her zeal, she'd contacted him wearing only a house coat tossed over her nightgown. How the gossips would talk if they knew he and Leia spoke like this late in the evening. But gossips were fools, and Ransom valued her lack of artifice. Leia hadn't held the truth back from him for a moment. After his first flush of enthusiasm, however, came doubt. I hesitate to point this out, Leia, but our first mission to Bastatha was fully endorsed by the Senate. Our work on Ryloth, Harloth Minor, and Daxam IV was either authorized or technically unofficial and entirely legal.
True,
Leia said with an eloquent shrug.
Anyone can have a dinner guest on Harloth Minor. Anyone can buy a Royal Guard helmet if he wants.
Ransom gave her a look. But using New Republic pilots and ships to take on potentially illegal work, traveling to a world known for criminal activity under what I assume will be false identification, you may well be overstepping your authority as a senator. She remained unfazed.
That's also true.
I feel the need to point out that such a mission will no doubt be extremely dangerous.
I can't deny it.
Ransom leaned closer to his comm unit.
I want in.
Leia's smile would have turned the night to day.
You know, I had a funny feeling you were going to say that.
You know me so well.
She became more serious then.
If by some chance you hadn't offered, I would have asked you along. If a populist senator on her own went out of bounds and came back with proof of a conspiracy based on centrist worlds, at best I'd be laughed off the Senate floor. At worst, I'd be censured. In either case, no one would believe me. But your presence on the mission gives us credibility. If we're able to prove the connections I think this trip to Cybensko will prove, and you and I present our evidence to the Senate together, we might just have a chance to make them listen.
We will, Ransom said. I'm sure of it.
Leia raised an eyebrow.
You have more confidence in the Galactic Senate than I do.
Sometimes she sounded so jaded, so cynical, even though she had been an idealistic revolutionary in her youth. Maybe a quarter century of politics did that to a person. At least, politics the way it had always been played in the New Republic. Ransom Casterfo intended to change the game. Chapter 21. The mission to Cybensko had to be kept secret, which meant that their meetings to plan this next adventure had to be disguised in some way. Ransom thought the most effective thing to do would be to hide in plain sight. So he reserved a pavilion along the riverside for the Equinox Day sun sail races, one of the traditional amusements on Hosnian Prime. In ancient times, it seemed, the equinox had been marked with boat races, and to this day, racers traversed a course that followed the river's winding path. People had gathered along the banks of the river, whether in verdigris-tinted pavilions or on blankets spread upon the grass. The massive capital city skyline seemed more distant than it was, contrasted with the simpler pleasures on offer here. Picnics were brought out by droids that rolled unevenly across the soft ground, or on hover trays owned by the wealthier or wiser. A few floating pods bobbed in the air only a meter or so above the water, each holding aloft a dozen or more spectators eager for the race. Autumn had officially begun, but on this day the sun still shone warmly. In every sense, the day felt like a celebration, and soon the preliminary air show would get started.
"How did you get out of the show?"
Ransom asked Joff Seastriker, the first of his guests to arrive.
"Aren't you one of their star pilots?"
"You'd better believe it."
Joff's blue eyes scanned the sky wistfully.
"I told the truth. Said Senator Organa wanted to discuss some of my work for her. You know, I don't think my commander even checked. You say her name and people straighten up."
"Woe betide anyone who doesn't,"
Ransom said, but fondly.
"When will Ms. Sonnel and young Corsella be joining us?"
With a shake of his head, Joff said,
"Corey's not coming. The mission's too dangerous for her to take part in, and Greer and Princess Leia figured they shouldn't stick Corey in a position where she could be accused of hiding information from the Senate."
"Sensible."
Then his gaze caught a familiar figure approaching in a coral-colored dress. Greer was almost unrecognizable, because of both her unexpectedly festive clothing and the wide smile on her face. It had not occurred to Ransom before this moment that even when Greer Sonnel was satisfied or enthusiastic, she rarely seemed happy.
"Hey there."
Greer came up the pavilion steps, her shining black hair swaying behind her. In her hands, she held a small bag containing something that seemed to be cylindrical and heavy.
"Are we talking strategy right away? Or do we first pretend to have a party?"
"I imagine we'll mix the two."
In the distance, Ransom could now see C-3PO toddling toward them. Leia couldn't be far off.
"Is this your offering for the celebration?"
Greer's smile had turned positively sly.
"A little something Joff was curious about on Pamarth."
She reached into the bag and pulled out a heavy glass bottle filled with reddish amber liquid.
"Here you go, fellas. Genuine, high-octane, Pamarthan port in a storm."
Smugly, Joff said,
"You finally realize I can handle it, huh?"
She arched one thick, wing-shaped eyebrow.
"Let's say I want to watch you try."
Ransom took the bottle into his hands, surprised at its heft. He'd heard of Port in a Storm, the famous fortified wine of Pamarth that had a reputation for taking even the strong to their knees. But many worlds had such stories. People from every single planet in the galaxy bragged about having the most powerful intoxicants, the spiciest food, or the worst weather. Everyone needed to stand out as the toughest of all. In reality, however, it was a big galaxy, which meant true extremes were hard to come by.
"If Lieutenant Seastriker is bold enough to sample it, I'll have a glass myself."
"Brave man,"
Greer said with a smile.
"Who brought the glasses?"
The pavilion had been duly stocked with a set. Ransom placed glasses on the table, and Greer filled them approximately halfway, maybe three fingers worth. He lifted his and held it out toward the others.
"A toast. To Princess Leia."
"To Princess Leia,"
Joff and Greer replied. In unison, they tipped back their glasses. He felt the sweetness and burn in his mouth. And then... Ransom had never asked himself what it might feel like if fireworks were set off within a human body. Now, he knew. His eyes widened as the fireball expanded within him, like a yellow dwarf star becoming a red giant. Noise seemed to fade for an instant, though he could hear Joff sputtering.